The storm arrived without warning, the way the worst things always do. One moment the sky above the moor had been the flat gray of old pewter, and the next it cracked open. Rain in sheets, wind that turned the carriage lanterns into useless orange smears, and a road that had no business being traveled in November dissolving into something closer to a riverbed than a path. Miss Cecily Ashworth gripped the leather strap above the window and told herself she was not frightened. She was merely alert. The axle gave with a sound like a pistol shot. The carriage lurched so violently that Cecily was thrown sideways into the door, her temple striking the frame with a force that made the darkness behind her eyes flare white. She heard her maid Agnes cry out. She heard the coachman shouting at the horses. And then everything was still, tilted, at an angle that made the floor feel like a hillside, and the rain hammered the roof with a kind of personal fury. Miss, Agnes was already reaching for her, hands finding her shoulder in the dark. Miss Ashworth, are you hurt?
I am fine, Cecily said, which was mostly true. Her head ached, and her pride ached more. She pressed her fingers to her temple, found no blood, and took that as a sufficient accounting of her condition.
Can you see anything? Agnes pressed her face to the streaming window.
A gate, she said. Iron. And a wall. And, miss, there are lights.
There were lights. Cecily could see them now through the rain. Not the scattered guttering lights of a farmhouse, but the steady, organized illumination of a great house, set back from the road, its windows glowing with the particular warmth of a place that had money enough to keep its fires burning through a November storm. The gate in the wall was tall and elaborate, and very firmly closed. The coachman appeared at the window, rain streaming from his hat brim.
Axel's gone, miss.
Clean through. We're not moving tonight. Cecily looked at the gate. She looked at the lights behind it. She thought about the 6 miles of empty moor between here and the nearest village, and the temperature, and Agnes's thin coat, and the horses standing in the rain. She opened the carriage door and climbed out into the storm. The gatekeeper's lodge was occupied. She could see the light under the door, and she hammered on it with the flat of her hand until a startled-looking old man opened it and stared at her, as though women materialized out of November storms with some frequency in his experience, but had never quite lost their capacity to surprise him.
I need to speak to whoever is in that house, Cecily said. The rain was already through her traveling cloak and working on her dress.
My carriage has broken down at your gate. I have a maid and a coachman and 2 horses. I am not asking for a great deal. I am asking for shelter until the storm passes and someone can fetch a wheelwright in the morning. The old man blinked at her.
That's Ashmore, miss, he said, as though the name should mean something.
I'm certain it is lovely, Cecily said. May I come in while you send word to the house? His name she learned while she stood dripping on his hearth and Agnes was retrieved from the carriage, was Gideon. And he had kept this gate for 31 years, and in 31 years he had never once sent an unannounced visitor up to the house.
His Grace, he explained carefully, did not receive visitors.
His Grace had not received visitors in, well, it had been some years now. His Grace had made himself quite clear on the subject.
Ma'am, His Grace, Cecily said, is presumably not standing in the rain.
Gideon looked at her for a long moment. Then he sent the message. The reply came back in less than 10 minutes, carried by a footman who had clearly run the full length of the drive and was nearly as wet as Cecily. The message was brief. His Grace would permit the stranded party to shelter in the east wing until morning. They were not to disturb the main house. Mrs. Hartley, the housekeeper, would see to their needs.
It was not warm. It was not welcoming. But the gate swung open, and that was enough. Ashmore was extraordinary. Even through the rain and the dark, Cecily could see that, the long drive lined with oaks that must have been 200 years old, the house itself rising at the end of it like something out of a dream of England, all pale stone and tall windows, and the kind of architectural confidence that came from never having had to question its own existence. It was also, she noticed as they came closer, slightly wrong. Not crumbling. Nothing so dramatic. But the garden beds on either side of the drive were overgrown in a way that spoke of deliberate inattention rather than poverty. Several of the ground floor windows were shuttered from within. The fountain in the forecourt was dry, its basin filled with dead leaves. The house was beautiful, and it was holding its breath. Mrs. Hartley met them at the side entrance, a compact woman of 60 with a face that gave nothing away and eyes that assessed Cecily in approximately 3 seconds and apparently found her acceptable. She showed them to a suite of rooms in the east wing that were clean and warm and entirely adequate, and she brought hot tea and cold meats and a change of clothes for Agnes. And she answered Cecily's questions about the wheelwright and the nearest smithy with the precise efficiency of someone who had spent decades managing a great house largely alone. "And His Grace?" Cecily asked, accepting her tea. "Should I write a note of thanks?" Something shifted in Mrs. Hartley's expression, not quite a smile. "His Grace does not generally read correspondence from guests," she said. "He does not generally have guests, but I will see that he knows you are grateful." She left. Cecily sat in the firelight with her tea and her aching head and listened to the storm batter the windows and thought about a house that held its breath and a man who had stopped receiving visitors and the particular quality of those shuttered windows. Not locked against the world coming in, she thought. Locked against the man inside going out. She slept better than she expected to. The storm had not finished with them by morning. Cecily discovered this when she opened the curtains at 7 o'clock and found the drive under 3 inches of standing water, and the sky the color of a bruise, and the rain still coming down with the patient, purposeful quality of weather that had decided it had nowhere else to be. She also discovered, when she sent Agnes to inquire about the wheelwright, that the road to the village was flooded at the low crossing, and that no one was going anywhere today. She dressed. She ate the breakfast Mrs. Hartley sent up. She read for 2 hours. She walked the length of the east wing corridor 4 times. She was midway through the 5th pass when she turned a corner and nearly walked directly into a man who had clearly not expected to encounter anyone in this part of the house. He was tall. That was the first thing. Tall and dark-haired and dressed with the kind of careless precision that suggested he had once cared very much about his appearance and had simply stopped thinking about it. His coat was good. His cravat was not particularly. He was carrying a book with his thumb marking his place, and he was staring at her with the expression of a man who has opened a familiar door and found an entirely different room behind it. "You," he said. It was not quite an accusation. It was not quite anything. "Me," Cecily agreed. "Miss Cecily Ashworth, your uninvited guest. I was going to write you a note of thanks, but Mrs. Hartley suggested you might not read it, so I was instead planning to express my gratitude in person if the opportunity arose." She paused. "The opportunity appears to have arisen." He looked at her for a moment, that stretched past comfortable. His eyes were gray, a dark, complicated gray, like the sky outside. And they held an expression she could not immediately name. Not hostility, not warmth. Something that had been neither for a long time and had perhaps forgotten which direction it had been pointed. "You should not be in this part of the house," he said. I was told the East Wing, Cecily said. I have been in the East Wing. This corridor connects to it.
It connects to the rest of the house as well. I turned left instead of right. I apologize for the navigational error.
She did not sound particularly apologetic.
She was not, she discovered, particularly apologetic. She had a headache and she was stranded and she was grateful for the shelter, but she was not going to apologize for existing in a corridor.
You are the Duke of Ashmore.
I am. My name is Cecily Ashworth. My carriage broke an axle at your gate last night. I am traveling to my aunt's house in Derbyshire. I expect to be out of your way as soon as the road clears.
She looked at him steadily.
I am not here to disturb you. I did not choose to be here. But I am here, and I would rather we were civil about it than otherwise.
Something moved in his expression. Something she almost identified before it was gone.
A Nathaniel, he said.
She blinked.
I beg your pardon.
My name, if we are to be civil.
He looked faintly uncomfortable with his own sentence, as though it had come out further than he had intended.
Nathaniel Ashmore, since you gave me yours.
Cecily looked at him. This tall, careful, slightly rumpled Duke standing in his own corridor, with his thumb in a book he had apparently been reading alone in a house that had stopped breathing. And she felt something she had not expected to feel. Not pity. Something more complicated than pity.
Nathaniel, she said, thank you for the shelter.
He nodded once, very correctly. Then he turned and walked back the way he had come. She watched him go and thought, there is a man who has been alone for a very long time and has decided that is the correct arrangement. She also thought, I turned left instead of right, and that is not nothing. The road did not clear on the second day, either. The flooding at the low crossing, Mrs. Hartley explained over breakfast, could take 3 to 4 days to recede in a rain of this duration. The wheelwright could not reach them until the road was passable.
Cecily was, in all practical terms, a resident of Ashmore for the foreseeable future.
She found the library on the second afternoon, following the smell of old paper and the instinct that a house like this must have one. It was magnificent. 2 stories of shelves, a gallery running the upper level, tall windows that would have filled the room with light on any day that was not this one, and a fireplace large enough to stand in that someone had clearly been using recently. The fire was burning well. There was a glass on the table beside the chair nearest the hearth. There was also a Duke standing at the upper gallery railing, looking down at her with an expression that had moved, she thought, from startled to something more carefully neutral.
I'll leave, she said immediately.
You don't have to.
He said it quickly, as though the words had surprised him as much as her.
A pause. It's a library. Libraries are meant to be used.
She stayed. They did not speak for the first hour.
She found a novel. Cecily had strong opinions about novels, and settled into the chair by the fire, and he came down from the gallery eventually and took the chair on the other side of the hearth with a different book, and they read in silence that was, she discovered, not uncomfortable. It was the silence of 2 people who had both learned to be quiet in rooms alone and found that being quiet in a room together was not so very different. He spoke first, eventually.
What are you reading?
She told him.
He had opinions about it.
Not the opinions she expected, which were the opinions of a man who had not read it. He had read it. He had read most things. It emerged over the course of an afternoon that stretched from 1 hour to 3, without either of them appearing to notice. He had been in this house for, he did not say exactly, but she gathered from the way he spoke about London, about the season, about other people, that it had been years, not months, years.
You don't go to London, she said. It was not quite a question.
No.
The season?
No.
Do you? She stopped herself.
Do I what?
She looked at him across the fire. He was watching her with those complicated gray eyes, and there was something in them that was not quite wariness and not quite hope, and was possibly both at once.
Do you miss it? She asked.
Any of it? The silence was long enough that she thought he would not answer.
I miss, he said carefully, the idea of it.
What it was supposed to be. He looked at the fire. I don't miss what it actually was.
What was it actually?
Another long pause. Loud, he said, and full of people performing versions of themselves that had very little to do with who they were. He glanced at her.
I found that exhausting.
Most people do, Cecily said. They simply don't have the option of retreating to a very large house in the middle of a moor. Something happened at the corner of his mouth. Not quite a smile. The ghost of one. The memory of the mechanism. Slightly rusty.
No,
he said. I suppose they don't. She went back to her book. But she was not really reading it anymore. On the third day, the rain softened to something more like suggestion than assault, and Cecily found herself in the garden. Or rather, she found herself in what had been a garden. The bones of it were still there, the paths and the walls, and the espaliered trees against the south-facing stone. But it had been left to its own devices long enough that it had developed opinions about what it wanted to be, and those opinions did not entirely align with the original design. She was examining a rose that had grown entirely over an iron arch when she heard footsteps on the gravel behind her. I haven't been out here in some time, Nathaniel said. He stopped beside her and looked at the rose with an expression she was beginning to recognize, the expression he wore when something caught him off guard, and he hadn't yet decided what to do about it. How long is some time? He thought about it.
3 years.
She looked at him. He was looking at the rose. It's not dead, she said. It's done what it wanted without anyone to direct it. She touched one of the canes, tracing the arc of it over the iron. There's something almost admirable about that.
There's something almost alarming about it, he said. It's taken over the arch entirely.
Yes, but look at it. She stepped back so he could see the full shape of it. The sprawling, exuberant, completely ungoverned growth of a thing that had been given years to become exactly what it was. It's magnificent, actually, if you can forgive it for not being what you originally planted it to be. He was quiet for a moment. Then, I'm not certain I know how to do that. She turned to look at him. He was still watching the rose, but his jaw was set in a way that told her the rose was not entirely what they were talking about.
Forgiving things for not being what you planned, she said.
Forgiving things for growing in directions I didn't account for. He looked at her then, briefly and quickly away. I had plans for this garden, for the house, for... He stopped. They didn't work out as I had intended.
Plans rarely do.
No. A pause. But most people don't respond to that by shutting the garden gate for 3 years.
Most people, Cecily said carefully, don't have a gate big enough to shut.
He looked at her again, and this time he didn't look away. The ghost of that almost smile was back, and it was closer to the real thing than it had been.
That is either a very kind observation, he said, or a very pointed one.
Both, she said. I find they're usually the same thing. He laughed. It was a short sound, startled out of him, and she had the impression it surprised him as much as it surprised her, that it was a sound he had not made in some time and had not expected to make now. He recovered quickly, composing his expression back toward careful neutrality. But she had heard it, and something in her chest did something she chose not to examine too closely. They walked the full length of the garden. He told her what it had been, the rose garden, the kitchen garden, the cutting garden for the house. She told him what it still was, underneath the overgrowth. They disagreed, pleasantly, about whether the yew hedge was salvageable. He said it was not. She said it was. Neither of them resolved the question, but neither of them seemed in any particular hurry to. That night, after dinner, they had been eating together since the second day, which had happened by a process neither of them had formally agreed to. She found him in the library again, the fire lower than it had been, a glass of brandy untouched beside him and a letter open on his knee that he was reading with the expression of a man who has read the same paragraph 4 times and found it no more palatable on the 4th reading. She settled into her chair without speaking. He folded the letter eventually and set it aside. "My mother," he said, unprompted. "She wants me to come to London for the season. She has been wanting this for 3 years. A pause. She sends a new argument each time. This one involves my duty to the dukedom. Last month's involved my father's memory. The month before, that involved a specific young woman she considers suitable. And none of the arguments have worked." "Clearly." Cecily looked at the fire. "What would work?" she asked. He was quiet for a long time, long enough that she thought he had decided not to answer. Then, "I don't know," he said. "I used to think nothing would. I used to think I had made a reasonable calculation, that the things I would lose by going back were worth less than the things I would lose by staying." He paused. "I'm less certain of that calculation than I was a week ago." She looked at him. He was looking at the fire, not at her, but his profile in the firelight was unguarded in a way it hadn't been on the first day, or the second. 3 days of shared silences and garden walks and arguments about yew hedges had worn away something, not the careful quality he carried, but the defensive purpose of it. He was still careful. He was careful the way a man is careful when he is trying to remember how not to be. "What changed the calculation?" she asked. He turned to look at her then. His eyes in the firelight were not gray so much as everything. All the complicated colors that gray contains when the light is right. He looked at her for a moment that had weight and texture and a quality she felt in her sternum. "I turned left instead of right," he said quietly. She felt her breath catch. She felt it catch and she did not look away. "Nathaniel," she said. Her voice was steadier than she felt. "Cecily." He said her name like it was something he had been holding carefully and was only now allowing himself to hold openly. "You are going to Derbyshire?" "I am." "The road will clear in a day, perhaps 2. "Yes." The fire cracked. The brandy sat untouched. Outside, the rain had softened to almost nothing. The first real quiet in 3 days. And the silence of the house had changed quality. It was not the held-breath silence she had noticed on the first night. It was something else. Something that had been waiting, she thought, for a long time, for someone to walk into it. "I don't want you to go," he said. It came out very simply, not dramatically, not with the performance of feeling, simply like a fact he had only just confirmed and was reporting accurately. "I am aware, that is. Not a reasonable thing to say to a woman I have known for 3 days." "It is perhaps not conventional," she agreed. Her heart was doing something she had no good vocabulary for. "But I find I am not particularly interested in convention at this moment." He stood. She stood. They were on the same side of the hearth, and the distance between them was not very much. And his expression had shed the last of its careful neutrality and was simply open, raw, in the way that faces are raw, when they have been defended for a long time, and the defense has finally been stood down. If I asked you to stay, he said, not forever, not... I am not asking you to make a decision in a library at midnight, but if I asked you to stay a little longer, to write to your aunt, to give me... He stopped, his jaw worked. To give me the chance to remember how to be a person who is not alone in a house on a moor. She looked at him. She thought about the garden and the rose that had grown without direction and become magnificent. She thought about a laugh that had surprised him. She thought about gray eyes in firelight and a thumb in a book, and a man who had made a calculation that was no longer adding up correctly. I'll write to my aunt, she said. He closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, the expression in them was something she had not seen there before, something that was not quite relief and not quite joy, but was the first tender shoots of both, pushing up through 3 years of carefully maintained frost. He reached out and took her hand, not dramatically, not urgently, simply took it. The way you take hold of something you have been afraid to reach for and have finally, carefully, reached for. His hand was warm. Hers was shaking slightly, and she did not try to hide it. Thank you, he said. Don't thank me yet, she said. I still think the yew hedge is salvageable. He laughed again, properly this time. The real thing, unguarded and warm and slightly wondering. The laugh of a man rediscovering a room he had locked and forgotten he missed. She thought it was one of the finest sounds she had heard in some time. They stood by the dying fire with their hands intertwined and the quiet house around them, and neither of them spoke for a while, and the silence was the best kind, the kind that has nothing left to defend. The letter to her aunt was written the following morning. The weeks that followed were not simple. Nothing worth having ever was. His mother arrived at the end of the first week, a small, fierce woman with Nathaniel's gray eyes and 30 years more practice at using them, who looked at Cecily with an assessment so thorough it felt almost surgical, and then, apparently satisfied with what she found, announced that she would be staying for a fortnight, and that the east drawing room needed to be opened immediately. Her name was Dorothea, and she had been trying to coax her son back into the world for 3 years, and she regarded Cecily's presence in his house with the barely concealed satisfaction of a general who has been waiting for exactly the right weather to launch an offensive. He laughed at dinner, she told Cecily privately, on the second day, over tea in the east drawing room that had been opened at her insistence. I haven't heard him laugh at dinner in 3 years. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it. We argue about the garden, Cecily said. Excellent, said Dorothea. He needs to argue with someone. He has been agreeing with himself for entirely too long. There was also, inevitably, a complication. His name was Lord Peregrine Vale, and he arrived with Dorothea's party, a handsome man with easy manners, and the particular polish of someone who had spent his adult life being charming and had never been asked to be anything else. He was a neighbor of Dorothea's in the county, and he was, it became apparent within approximately 48 hours, interested in Cecily. He was also, she discovered over the course of several dinners and one long afternoon in the gallery, where he showed her the portraits and told her the family histories, with a fluency that suggested he had told them before, very good at appearing to be something he was not. You know, he said to her one afternoon, while Nathaniel was occupied with his steward, Ashmore is a beautiful house. It is, Cecily agreed, and he has kept it very well, for a man who has been absent from the world. He smiled. The smile was perfect, though I wonder sometimes if he knows quite what to do with company. He has been alone a long time. Old habits. People can change their habits, Cecily said. Of course, the smile again. I only mean, you are a practical woman, Miss Ashworth. I can see that. And a practical woman might wonder whether a man who has chosen solitude for 3 years is choosing something else now because he genuinely wants it, or because... He tilted his head. Because you are simply the most interesting thing that has happened to him in a very long time. A novelty, rather than a choice. The words landed precisely where he had aimed them. She felt them land. She did not let him see it. Thank you for the portraits, she said pleasantly, and excused herself. She found Nathaniel in the library that evening. He was at the window, watching the last of the light leave the garden, and he turned when she came in with an expression that shifted from something private to something warmer, and she thought, No, that is not a man performing. That is a man who has forgotten how to perform because he has spent 3 weeks being real. But the words had found their mark, and she was honest enough with herself to know it. Nathaniel, she said, I need to ask you something. He turned fully, reading her face. His own grew careful in a different way than it used to be careful. Not the defended way, but the way of a person who sees that someone they care about is hurting and is trying to understand why. Ask, he said. Am I... She stopped, tried again. Is this... She shook her head. Lord Vale suggested that I might be a novelty, that after enough solitude anyone would seem... No. He said it before she had finished the sentence, flat and certain and without qualification. He crossed the room in 4 strides and stopped in front of her, and his expression was the most unguarded she had ever seen it. Not the careful incremental openings of the past weeks, but something stripped to the bone. No, I want you to hear me say this clearly, because I have not been clear enough and I should have been. You are not a novelty. You are not a distraction. You are not the most interesting thing to happen to me, because nothing else has happened. He paused, and his voice was very low and very steady. You are the reason I opened the curtains. You are the reason I went into the garden. You are the reason I wrote back to my mother and told her she could come. He looked at her with those gray eyes that were not gray so much as everything. I have been alone in this house for 3 years, and in 3 weeks you have made me remember what I was before I decided that was the correct arrangement. That is not novelty. That is you, specifically and entirely you. She felt something crack in her chest, the last of the doubt giving way. I was afraid, she said, that you would wake up one morning when the roads were clear and wonder why you had asked me to stay. I wake up every morning, he said, relieved that you did. He reached up and cupped her face in both hands with the terrible tenderness of someone who has been very careful for a very long time and has decided finally to stop being careful. She covered his hands with hers. The roads have been clear for 2 weeks, she pointed out. I know. Something in his voice, warm and wry and entirely certain. I may have spoken to the wheelwright about the timeline. She stared at him. You did not. I suggested, he said carefully, that there was no particular urgency. She laughed, startled, delighted, helplessly. And he was laughing too, and they were standing in the library with their foreheads almost touching and their hands intertwined. And she thought, this is what it looks like when a held breath finally releases. He kissed her, softly at first, the careful first contact of a man who has been afraid of wanting things and is learning, slowly, that wanting is not the same as losing. Then less softly. Then with the full warmth of 3 weeks of proximity and garden arguments and midnight fires and 2 people who had both been, in their different ways, alone
and had found in each other the particular relief of being known. When they broke apart, she pressed her forehead to his shoulder and felt his arms come around her and the fire warm at their backs. "I have to actually go to Derbyshire at some point," she said into his coat. "I know." His voice was low, his chin resting on her hair. "I was thinking I might come with you, if your aunt would receive me." She lifted her head to look at him. "You would leave Ashmore?" He looked at her steadily. "I would leave Ashmore," he said. "For a great many things I would not have considered leaving it for 3 weeks ago." She searched his face, found nothing there but honesty, the plain, ungarnished honesty of a man who had spent 3 years in careful solitude and was offering, with both hands, to come back out into the world. "My aunt," she said, "will absolutely receive a duke." He smiled, the real one, full and warm and slightly wondering, the smile of a man who is still getting used to the fact that he has one. "Then we'll go to Derbyshire." They were married in the spring, in the small church at the edge of the Ashmore estate, with Dorothea in the front pew radiating the satisfaction of a woman who has been proven entirely right. The vows were the traditional ones, but Nathaniel had added a line that was not traditional, spoken quietly enough that only she could hear it. "I choose this. I choose you. Every morning, deliberately, I choose you." She had not been able to speak for a moment after that. She had simply taken his hands and held them, and thought about axles and gates and storms, and the particular grace of things that break in exactly the right place. 2 years later, the yew hedge had been restored to something approaching its original shape. Cecily had been right about that, as she had reminded Nathaniel on approximately 4 separate occasions, and the rose over the iron arch had been trained rather than removed, so that it kept its magnificent sprawl, but no longer entirely obscured the path. The garden was alive again. The house was alive again. Several of the shuttered windows had been opened, and the fountain in the forecourt ran clear in the summer. And there were, as of 8 months ago, small boots in the entrance hall. On a Tuesday morning in November, Cecily found Nathaniel in the library. Their library now, its chairs rearranged to accommodate 2 people reading simultaneously. With their daughter asleep on his chest and a book open in his free hand that he was very clearly not reading. "She won't sleep in her crypt," he said without looking up. "She never sleeps in her crib," Cecily said. She settled into her chair and watched him. This man who had been a held breath and was now a full lung, who had been a shuttered window and was now every curtain open to the light. "Tell me something," he looked up. "What would you like to know?" "Tell me about the wheelwright," he smiled, slow and warm and slightly guilty. I told him there was no particular urgency. "You said that. I want the details." "The details," he said, "are that I had spoken to a woman in a corridor for approximately 4 minutes and found myself entirely unwilling to have her leave, and so I made a calculation." He looked at her across the firelight, across the sleeping child, across 2 years of chosen mornings. "It was the first calculation I had made in 3 years that felt correct." Cecily looked at him, at the open curtains and the living garden beyond the window, and the small boots in the hall, and the man who had learned, slowly, to stop holding his breath, and she felt the particular warmth of a thing that had been fought for and won, and was now simply, beautifully, hers. "It was correct," she said. He reached across the space between their chairs and took her hand. Outside, the November sky was doing something tentative with light, the first pale suggestion of winter sun through the clouds, and the yew hedge cast its restored shadow across the garden path.
and somewhere in the house, a door opened and closed with the ordinary music of a place that was, finally and entirely, alive. Thank you for staying with Cecily and Nathaniel until the very end. Their story began with a broken axle and a closed gate and became something neither of them had the courage to plan for. Proof that the best arrivals are the ones you didn't choose. If you want more stories about impossible circumstances and the people brave enough to stay in them, subscribe and ring the bell, because there are more waiting for you. Every single one of these stories exists because you're here to hear them. Thank you for that. Truly.